Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. For something like 200 years now, Americans, many Americans, have believed that if they worked hard and if they drew on their intelligence and their skills, that they would move up the economic ladder. In this hour of the show today, we'll explore this question. Does, in fact, this kind of mobility exist today in America? Is it, in fact, still the land of opportunity? To help us discuss this this morning, we have as our guest Julia Isaacs. She is a child and family policy fellow at the Brookings Institution, and she is one of the contributors to a recently published report from Brookings they call Getting Ahead or Losing Ground, Economic Mobility in America, and it's something that you can read on the Brookings website. Just go to brookings.edu, and there is a wide range of information on all sorts of domestic and international policy issues, and you will find this report there as well. So if you're interested in exploring it in some detail, you can do that. We here will ask some basic questions and give you the opportunity to do the same here this morning in this hour of Focus 580 as we talk some more with Julia Isaacs. Let me tell you a little bit more about her. Before she joined Brookings, she was Director of Data and Technical Analysis in the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Before that, she spent several years doing research on childhood development and school finance at the American Institutes for Research, and also 10 years providing policy analysis to the U.S. Congress through the Congressional Budget Office. She is joining us this morning by telephone. And again, as we talk, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, so that if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number, and we'll pay for the call. That is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Ms. Isaacs, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Good to talk with you.
We appreciate it. I suppose that there would be a number of ways to answer this question. Is there, in fact, still something that we call the American dream? And I suppose it depends on how it is, you know, how it is one defines that. Like you, though, basically, I think have there are a number of things we can talk about here, but you're focusing on the idea that people have, the expectation that people have that they'll do better than their parents, that when we go from one generation to the next, that not only is the standard of living going to rise, but that where people are on the economic ladder, that's the metaphor that's used in the report, and it's a good one, I think, for people to understand what we're talking about, that they are going to move up. That's the expectation. So I suppose then that's the big question to start with, and is the place we are today, is it still possible for people to move up that ladder?
So I think you've done a good job of summarizing the two types of mobility we talk about. We're looking at families across generations, and one is whether the family, the second generation, has a higher income than the first generation. And we find, indeed, yes, that two out of three adults today have higher family income than their parents had back, like, in the late 1960s. But the second question we look at is, how do you do relative to your parents on the economic ladder? If your parents were in the bottom 20%, are you also caught in the bottom 20%? And we can't have everybody move up on that second measure. There's only 100%, and someone's got to be in the bottom 20%. So the question really is, what are your chances of ending up in the bottom 20% or the top 20%, depending where your parents began?
Mm-hmm. I suppose one has this notion that if the economy is strong enough, that everybody goes up. That it's the rising tide that lifts all the boats. If people will forgive the tired sort of a
no, yes, sort of we did have that up through about the early 1970s. We had pretty strong economic growth after World War II, and everybody was lot of people were doing better than their parents. And then the economy has slowed down in the past several decades, but we're still finding that 2 out of 3 Americans, if you add up family income, if it's a married couple, the husband and wife's earnings together are higher than what their parents were 30 years earlier.
But there, I think it's probably important to add the qualifier that while it is true that these households have a higher standard of living than their parents did, they're also smaller. People have fewer children, and one very significant difference is that now we have many women who are working outside the home. So in part, that increase in well-being, in economic well-being, has come because we have more households where they've got two earners, and we have fewer dependents.
Yes, you've put your finger on one of the findings of our report, which is that while we've seen this growth in family incomes, it is driven by the rise in two-earner families. We looked separately at men's incomes and found that they've been quite flat over this period. So we looked at men in their 30s and compared them to men in their 30s 30 years ago, and we don't see an increase. In fact, we see a slight decrease in the earnings in the middle. So what's happening, what's driving family income, is that women have entered the workforce, gotten college degrees, earned higher earnings, and a lot of them are working more hours per week. And that's why family income has gone up.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's been much commented upon in the last 20 years, is the issue of economic inequality. That is the spread between the people who are at the top and the people who are at the bottom, and how much of the wealth that the people at the very top have, and so forth. Can you say something about economic inequality?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that motivated this work that was funded by the Pew Charitable Trusts. And here at Brookings and at Pew, we've been interested in looking at this issue of inequality, but looking at it from a different angle, the angle of mobility. When you look at inequality, you're also seeing a single point in time, we do indeed people at the very top have higher incomes than people at the bottom, a lot higher now than in the past. And some people have said, well, that's okay because different people are at the top, different members of families and all. And what this study says is, no, we haven't really seen an increase in mobility over time. It's hard to study trends. Mm-hmm. But during this period when we've been seeing rising inequality, the best evidence suggests that, the evidence is mixed. But there's not evidence of an increase in mobility. In fact, there's some evidence that mobility has gone down.
Mm-hmm. Why? I suppose some people might say, well, if it is the case that people's standard of living, there it is, the amount of money that they, the amount of income that they have, and things like what kind of house they have, and what kind of car they drive, and their ability to send their kids to college or go on vacation or whatever, that if that does continue to go up, then why is this mobility issue such an important one?
Well, I think it has to do with the whole idea of equality of opportunity. The question is, do children have equal chances of rising in society? And we find that while incomes are up overall, your family background has a strong influence on where children end up. If your parents are poor, or actually if your parents are African American at any income level, we find the children don't rise as high on the income ladder. Having a college education helps, but also coming from a wealthy family or being Caucasian, that also helps. And I have some statistics to explain sort of what I mean by this.
Yeah. Well, I think this is an important and interesting idea that, in fact, for a lot of people, your place on the economic ladder is inherited. It's a matter of what your family background is, and that with perhaps the possible exception for some of the people who are right in the middle, it tends to be very much the case, as you've said, is that if your family was one of the families at the top or if your family was one of the families at the bottom, chances are that's where you're going to be.
Right. So if we look at those families in the middle, we see that they have about a 20% chance of going to the top 20% and 20% chance of going to the bottom 20%. So that's pretty strong mobility. I'm rounding a little bit. But yeah. People at the bottom, whose parents were in the bottom, they have a 42% chance of staying at the bottom and only a 6% chance of doing this sort of rags-to-riches increase in one generation. Whereas those who started at the top, 39% end up at the top. So compare a 39% chance of ending up at the top because your parents are rich versus a 6%, and you'll see that there is a difference in your odds of reaching the top of the income distribution depending where your parents were.
Mm. Just very quickly to introduce again our guest, Julia Isaacs. She is the Child and Family Policy Fellow at the Brookings Institution. She is also our first Focus Fellow, one of the contributors to a recently published report that came out of Brookings that's titled Getting Ahead or Losing Ground, Economic Mobility in America. And as I mentioned, if you'd like to read this, you can do that by going to the website of Brookings. That's brookings.edu. Look at that, and there's a lot of other material there on many other different subjects, but if you're interested in this particular report, you can read an overview, you can read the entire thing, and questions here on the program are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, perhaps we could talk a little bit about, look at the at least these three major divisions, the top, the middle, the bottom, and talk about what's going on there, and particularly why it is that, I guess it's probably a little easier to understand how it is that the people at the top would remain on the top because of the number of advantages the fact that they start out at the top confer on them. What's going on the bottom, and why is it so difficult for people who are born into families who are on the bottom rungs of the ladder to pull themselves up?
Well, that's a good question. What we're doing in this report was laying out the basic facts of how much mobility is there, how has it changed over time, how do we compare with other countries. And we did not, you know, in the 100 pages, go to the further question of why is this happening. That's something we may do in further research. This is a ongoing project by a number of different think tanks participating together.
Mm-hmm. So, but I guess we, again, to go back to the basic point, it is true that, is it true that in the past there has been more mobility than there is now? So if people, if we're looking at this basic question, well, what's going on with this idea that you can indeed move up, that it is not as easy as it once was, and that if there is much mobility, it is definitely more in the middle and not so much on the I guess people on top, well, they can take care of themselves. It's the people maybe we're most going to be concerned about, those people who are on the bottom. Certainly for them, it is very difficult for them to even to move up into the middle.
Yeah, well, when you compare over time, some of the, you know, the particular data set I'm using goes back to 1968. So if you want to go back to like the 18th century, we have to draw on other sources. And certainly European visitors to the United States, like Alexis de Tocqueville, spoke about all the mobility here in the United States. But now when we do comparisons between the United States and Europe, the best available evidence suggests that we have less mobility in the United States than in Europe. In particular, these families at the bottom, I was saying it's about 42% of those, in this case I'm looking at men, whose their fathers were in the bottom of the wage distribution and they are in the bottom of the earnings distribution. In European countries, that's more like 25 to 30%. So we have more stickiness at the bottom here than in Europe now, whereas if we trust the accounts from the 18th and early 19th century, it was the reverse.
Mm-hmm. Even in Canada, they have apparently more mobility, more economic mobility than we do here now in the United States.
Yeah, I found that a little bit puzzling because I think of Canada as being somewhat similar to the United States in a number of ways. But when you look at this question of relative mobility, moving up and down relative to your parents, there seems to be more mobility in Canada as well as in, you know, Sweden and other countries, mm-hmm, than in here in the United States.
We have a caller here to bring in the conversation. Let's do that. We have someone here listening in Champaign on our line one. Hello.
Hi. I've got a question for you. Interesting conversation. I'm wondering if you could elaborate if you find any cultural differences from people who came to this country, let's say from Asian countries. One of the things that you tend to notice is, it's just there's a different mentality when people come from another country that they tend to their parents aspire them to go to school, to stay in school, to get a higher, better education, all those things. Can you expand and see if you actually found that in your data as well? I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
All right.
Well, we do have a chapter in this volume which looks at immigrants. It was written by my co-author, Ron Haskins, at the Brookings Institution. When we look at immigrants, we see a number of types of mobility. First, when the first generation immigrant moves to this country, if they're moving from a poorer country, there's the mobility that we sometimes talk about just by entering the country, where there's a higher earning space here. But then when we look at the second generation, the immigrant may have lower earnings than native-born Americans, but higher earnings than he would have had back in his home country. Then when we look at the second generation, we see that the children of immigrants tend to move up relative to their parents and get closer to the average earnings of native-born. So I'm addressing your question in terms of saying, yes, we are seeing that immigrants who come to this country do have their children do better. We didn't in this study look at the different reasons underlying differences in mobility, but certainly there are a lot of speculation and other research that we haven't done that looks at why different groups may move up higher than others, and that's something we hope to look into further.
Mm-hmm. I guess the important thing is here is that people do, generally speaking, people do get a big bump up in their economic standards when they come to the United States. I suppose it's not true for everybody, but it's true for a lot of people do get this big bump up. But then as the longer they and their family are in the United States, then the more they start to look like other Americans.
Yes, the second generation does tend to have higher earnings. They also tend to sometimes adopt some of our social problems as well, but we do find the second generation looking more like native-born Americans. And you're also correct to say that some immigrants to this country are very highly educated and well-paid and aren't doing worse than native-born Americans. We have immigrants sort of on both ends of the income distribution.
Mm-hmm. Is there much difference in now in terms of what you would predict for a person's for how a person will do, particularly as compared with their parents, according to gender? That is, now do girls and boys within the whatever group they fall into, are girls and boys relatively equal in what they can expect?
Yeah, we did have one chapter looking at differences from men and women, and I authored that chapter. And in terms of this intergenerational mobility, we don't see much difference between sons and daughters when we measure family income. So when you take into account the daughter's earnings and if she's married, her spouse's earnings, together their income, would resemble her parents' income to the same extent that her brother's would. Some of them are mobile and some of them are not. Sort of the same statistics I was giving you of about 40% of those at the top staying at the top and 40% at the bottom staying at the bottom. That's pretty much true of both men and women. One exception is that women whose parents are at the bottom tend to do a little bit worse. 47% of them stay at the bottom rung compared to 35% of sons. So we are seeing a little bit of difference at the bottom for women compared to men, but in the rest of the income distribution, the story is more that men and women have similar ties to their parents in terms of where they end up in the income distribution.
Yeah, so gender may be a slight role, but is still, I suppose you're still looking at that. The word you use to describe it is that stickiness that you see at the top and the bottom of the income distribution of people having it. Essentially, as we've said, the chances are that if you're born into that place on the economic ladder, it's going to be very difficult for you. It's going to be unlikely that if you're on the top that you're going to fall down, and on the bottom it's going to be very difficult for you to grab the rungs on the ladder up from where you are and to pull yourself up.
Yes, and when we're talking about women, many women of course have earnings, but the family income still may be somewhat dominated by the men's earnings, and so one of the interesting things that happens is people often marry people who look like their parents. When I say look like their parents, in this case I'm meaning economically. And so you're likely to marry someone whose earnings potential is similar to that of your father if you're a woman, or if you're which could be good or bad, sort of depending where on the income distribution you're starting. And the other thing I'll say is, while we talk about the stickiness, you know, I don't want to overemphasize it. Mm-hmm. If I say 40% in the bottom stay in the bottom, that actually means that more than half do move up to either to the second or third or fourth or very top quintile.
Well, I think it's a good thing to emphasize that point, because it does say that we're not saying that there's no mobility at all. It's just that depending on where you are, it may be more difficult. So then if you ask that, and I know that you're mostly, your purpose here is looking at statistics and at numbers, and not quite so much in saying, well, why is that the case? But can you say anything about that 60% of the people on the bottom that do manage to get around that stickiness and manage to move up? What about them makes that possible, or are there things about them that help them move up?
Well, one thing that helps you move up that we did look at is a college education.
Mm-hmm.
So if we talk about these kids who started at the bottom, if they have a college degree, 19% of them go all the way to the very top, compared to only 5% of poor kids without a college degree. So getting a college degree, which itself, it helps to have richer parents to help you get a college degree, so there's a little bit of a chicken and egg issue. But once, if you can get a college degree, that's probably education, and the college degree is really something that correlates very strongly with rising to the top or from the bottom to the middle of the income distribution.
Yeah, that seems to be there's nothing else other than perhaps the family what's the family like that you came from? Almost nothing else that you can point to that has that kind of significance post-secondary education has.
I think that is the thing which we focused on. There are other things that help. Well, I guess I can put in reverse terms that we were talking about the importance of two-earner families. And if you end up not marrying at all and are relying on one person's income, or if you get married and get divorced, both being unmarried and being divorced is associated with having poorer economic outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
But the education, I think, has a very strong role in increasing people, both men and women's, family income.
Yeah. Let's talk with some other folks here. Again, someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wonder if you'd care to comment on a scenario that comes to my mind that I know Marx is in a lot of favor these days, but he maintains at one point that a capitalist society likes to have about 10% of its population in poverty because it drives down the wages of other people, because, you know, you can always threaten the 10% above them with the people that are below them in wages. And if you thought of a political fact that would account for, like, the fact that we do have this great disparity in wealth, and that the fact that the people that have the wealth keep things in play that allows them to, like, concentrate wealth, like, you know, in a greater percentage at the top, and they have in pre-revolutionary France at this point, I think. And if it's just a political factor, and, like, especially when you think of other cultures, like all of Western Europe, for instance, where they do have a better system for allowing people to rise up, and they have a little better system for the people at the very bottom. And maybe you'd like to talk about that? Thanks.
Okay, well, you can respond to that however you can.
I think I have two things to say. The first is just to clarify that the particular way I'm measuring where you are in the income distribution, by definition, 20% of the people are in the bottom 20%, because I'm not saying below a certain poverty level. I'm just actually using 20%. So by definition, I have 20% in the bottom. But ignoring that sort of technical issue, I think your broader question is getting to some of the, you know, political economy differences that there might be between the United States and Europe, and the fact that we think that we tend to think in this country, if you look at international comparisons, we tend to think we have this belief in the American dream, and we tend to think that we will if you work hard, you'll get ahead. And so we have more belief in that than in other countries, and we also have less concern about income inequality and less interest in having the government make redistributive policies. There's a question that asks people in 27 countries, do you think it's the job of government to address differences between income? And the United States says yes less often than citizens in other countries. And we think it's partly because people think there's all this mobility. But what's striking in our report is to find that there's less mobility here than at least the rich industrialized countries. At least if we can measure in our evidence. I have to be a little bit cautious because it's different data sets. But so I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I am agreeing with you that we have less mobility here and more mobility in Western Europe, and that political economy could be part of that reason.
All right. Again, I hope the caller will forgive me for going on. I have a number of other people here waiting, and we'll go next to Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. I think the issue of income mobility is almost a secondary issue when we look at the cause of it. European societies seem to have higher mobility because of better access to good education and less worries about health care. That leaves families a lot more freedom to allow their kids to go to whatever length their abilities will take them. We, on the other hand, tend to measure everything in terms of income instead of welfare of the families in terms of their access to amenities that are good for us. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, it is true that in my study I am focusing on family income, and I would agree that's at best only a proxy for well-being. And so that it's important to look at, you know, the cost of education, the cost of health care, to see whether families with, you know, we have more income now, but how are the prices of things comparing? But it's very hard to measure, you know, family welfare or economic well-being by something other than income, and we chose family income as sort of the best proxy for well-being, but I'd agree it's not perfect.
I think the family welfare does depend and probably can be measured in terms of what infant mortality and morbidity or longevity rates are, and what sort of what income level goes into taking care of children's education. Welfare is not just what the government doles out, but how people feel, how comfortable they are within their incomes. I think substituting income distribution for how well the families are doing does not give a full picture.
No, and there is a literature that tries to use surveys to ask people about happiness or to try to measure. I've done some work looking at material hardship, whether people are running out of money before the end of the month. There's things you can use other than income to try to get at either well-being or hardship, but I guess I would say that those measures, it's hard to know how well a person's doing. You know, if you get into happiness, then there's subjective issues. family income isn't perfect, but I think the other measures of well-being, I mean, if you go to something like infant mortality and longevity, those are fairly objective. It's harder to track changes with that, but that is something you can do. So I agree. It's important to look at well-being, but there's not like an easy measure of well-being.
David had mentioned before that part of the income increases we have experienced in our country here is because of both husband and wife working. But that has its downsides, even though those families have become smaller. The difficulties that any family, any woman especially, will attest to is how to take care of your children in your absence, and it matters a lot whether you are in attendance or not. I don't want to take too much of your time, but I'll just bring that up and hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yes, and on that last point, yes, we do talk in our report about that very fact. With one of the sort of main things we emphasize is that this rise in family incomes has been driven by women entering the labor force. And yes, there are a variety of sort of implications of women working, including challenges with childcare if the family has children.
Yeah. We are a little bit past the midpoint here. I have some other callers we'll get to in just a moment, but for anyone who has tuned in within the last 5 or 10 minutes, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Julia Isaacs. She is the Child and Family Policy Fellow at the Brookings Institution and also our first Focus Fellow. And she is one of the contributors to a report here that we're talking about that it tries in one way, and that is by looking at economic mobility to explore this question, is it possible for people to move up the economic ladder? Of course, it has been the case for a long time that we have believed in this country that people who work hard can succeed, and we have this expectation that people will do better than their parents did, and that will continue over time, that families will move up the ladder. The question in looking at economic mobility that the scholars who have contributed to this report are trying to answer is that in fact true here in America? If you'd like to read this report in detail, it's available at the website of Brookings. So go to www.brookings.edu and you can read it. And, of course, questions are welcome here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just again, let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, Julia Isaacs. Before joining Brookings, she worked as Director of Data and Technical Analysis in the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She also worked at the American Institutes for Research and also the U.S. Congressional Budget Office. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have other questions, and we'll next talk with someone here in Urbana. Again, line number three. How about Belgium? Line number four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. My question and observation might be somewhat along the last caller's. In your studies, did you ask the basic question, do you feel better than you've done better than your parents? Even though maybe economically you hadn't, but yet you may very well feel much better off than what you feel your parents feel they were better off. You understand what I'm trying to say?
I think I follow your question. There are survey questions that ask people, are you better off than 5 years ago? And do you think your children will be better off than you are? I'm less familiar with people saying, are you better off than your parents, because that's asking people to think back 30 years. But when we ask people, do you think your children will do better than you are, than you're doing, we're at a point in American history where that response, fewer people say yes than at other points. And it's a sign of some kind of malaise, I would say, in the country where people are worried that their children may not do better than they are. When we ask if you think you'll do better in 5 years, I don't have those data right in front of me, but those go up and down sort of over time depending how the economy is doing.
So you really didn't ask people whether they thought they were doing better than their parents. You just asked if they thought they'd do better, their kids would do better than them.
See, yeah, in our survey we didn't ask either question, but there are other surveys that ask the question of, do you think your children will do better than you? Because that is something that, you know, is a measure of how people are feeling about the future. And so that's, it's used that way.
Thank you very much.
Right, thank you. I guess just to go back, though, to talk about the main focus here, your interest is not so much in asking people or in getting at people's standard of living, because the fact is that that people today, adults today, generally are better off than their parents. They do have a higher standard of living That's, and although, as we have explained, that that is in part because now we have many households where we have two earners and people are having fewer children. But the fact is that they are better off. That's not quite the issue that you're most interested in, which is a little bit a different kind of a thing that has to do with, it's not just do you have a bigger house than your parents? Do you have a nicer car? Is your monthly paycheck more, you know, do you have a color TV and that sort of thing? It has more to do with the idea that in a larger sense, over time, we're expecting people to move up. So not just having more money in their pocket exactly, but if you think of the economy as a kind of a ladder, the issue is where on the ladder are you? And that what we're saying is that it's yes, people may have more money in their pockets, but they're on the same spot on the ladder that their parents were, and that it is much more likely that's going to be the case if you're on the bottom or if you're at the top than if you're in the middle.
Yeah, well, we're interested in both questions. Do you, how much has the whole ladder gone up? How much has income? I'm adjusting for inflation, I should hasten to say. So after adjusting for inflation, how much real growth in income has there been over the last 30 years? And we are interested in that question. And are finding that people have more income than their parents. But then the second question, as you point out, has to do with how much movement is there across the income distribution. So everyone has more income, but where you end up, is it, to what extent is it driven by your parents having low income, middle income, or high income? And the issue we haven't talked about yet, which was one of the surprising aspects of our study, is it also depends very much on your race,
yes,
whether your parents,
yes,
are African American or Caucasian.
Yes, that's. I think that that's. I'm. It was one point I wanted to make sure that we get to, and I think that it is important to mention that. And as you find that this is something that's true for all African Americans all the way along the way, and that it's even true for those who were in the middle, that group where now we do actually see the greatest mobility, it's less the case for African Americans than for other Americans.
Right. I'd said that for children in general, if your parent, and we're looking at children from families in 1968, people who are 0 to 18 in 1968, if their parents were in the middle of the income distribution, having income, let's say, about $56,000 today's dollars, families in the middle of the income distribution, the white children ended up about equal chances of going to the top, going to the bottom, staying in the middle. The African American children were much more likely to fall down to the bottom of the income distribution. 45% of them fell from the middle who were in the middle fell to the bottom. And so we're seeing that African American families are not passing on middle income advantages the way that white families are.
And well, maybe one more thing, and I want to make sure I get this right, so you can check me on this, that because I'm sure some people will question this idea about overall income growth, the proverbial rising tide. While it has continued to rise and everybody goes up, that the rate of increase has slowed down quite a bit. So it hasn't gone up as fast as it has in the recent years, as in the past. I think maybe around 1970 or so. I think that's the time
maybe
when things really.
Maybe 1973, somewhere in there. There was a big period of growth after World War II, and we're in a slower period where incomes are rising less quickly. And as I think you pointed out, there's also been more of the gains have been unequally distributed.
Right.
And so there's been less income growth and more income inequality. And it's in that context that we want to say, okay, so it's harder to do well just because the whole society is going up, although people still are. It also makes a big difference whether you're at the top or the bottom. So then the question of what are your chances of getting to the top? How much mobility is there? This question becomes so important because there's less economic growth and more inequality than in, let's say, 30 years ago.
Yeah, okay. Another caller here, someone on a cell phone who is on the road, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I was calling with a response to the gentleman who spoke about the European system and the fact that welfare can be measured not only in terms of monetary gain, To speak to that, I think that one of the important things to remember is that in the United States, where most of us do not have extended maternity leave with a guaranteed job at the end of that time, or emergency room visits that are 100% covered, income is a key to all of the things that promote our welfare here in the United States, where it may, in fact, not be key as much in some of the European countries. The other point I wanted to make is on a totally different tack, and that is that I feel that in some ways I would have to fall into the group where my response would be that I think my children will be less well off than I will be, than I am. And I think part of this is because I see my children being less self-sufficient. They don't know how to plant a garden. They don't know how to roof their house with their friends. They don't know how to change a tire. They don't know how to do a lot of the basic things that now, if you want to get those things accomplished, you have to pay for, because those skills are being lost. And I think that that lends some lack of self-sufficiency to a lot of people in this country, and I think that that is going to be hard for our upcoming generation of children. They're just a little bit further out on a limb than even I am. That's all I have to say.
Well, interesting thoughts. I don't know how much you feel that you could respond to that, Ms. Isaacs.
No, those are interesting thoughts. I didn't really hear a question, but I found them useful thoughts to think about.
And it certainly suggests there are some other things we could pursue with other guests at other points. I am interested in this idea, what happens when you ask people, do you think that your children will, are you better off? Have you done better than your parents? And do you think that your children will do better than you? Whether there at some point there has been a significant kind of shift to increasing numbers of people saying, well, actually, it does concern me that I don't think that my children would do as well.
Right. And our study, we were looking at actual income. We had families from 1968. We asked the parents, what is your income, and tracked them the next year in 69. What was your income in 70? What was your income? And then when their parents moved out of the house, this is the panel study on income dynamics out of the University of Michigan. And so we aren't just sort of asking people, what's your sense of your parents' income? We know what their parents' income was. Well, we know what they reported, and we know what the children's income is. So we're doing a direct comparison, which makes this a very rich study to be able to directly compare families across generations. This question, this other question of how do you feel that your children will be doing, I'm less familiar with that data because we didn't study it, but my understanding is there has been a shift, and it sort of has been trending down and is at one of its lowest points, and that is of concern because I think it's signaling that there's something going on with children's policy and with children that is not healthy. As it could be overall concerns about the economy, but also could be concerns that children are not getting quite the attention they need to succeed in life. They need to get the skills now so that when they're adults, they will succeed.
Well, let's continue, and we will talk next with another caller, and this is someone also on a cell phone on line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have two quick questions. One, the first one is, with the various percentages that you've used, and also you use the word rich to define one group, would you please define those groups for me? And then the second, with retirees, what kind of changes have been made or have taken place among retiree groups? Thank you, and I'll listen on the radio.
So those are two good questions. I'm glad to have the chance to clarify. So what I'm doing is I'm looking at people by quintiles, the word we use, people in the bottom 20% or the top 20%. And by bottom 20% in the current generation, I would mean less than $40,000 in family income, both the whole family's income combined. And the top 20% is above $117,000. people who are making $117,000 may not realize that they're in the top 20% of families in the United States, but they are. In the middle would be more like $62,000 to $84,000. If we go back to the parents' generation, everybody's income is somewhat lower, and I can give that if you're still interested. But I want to get to your second question, which was asking about retirees. So in this study, I'm looking at a particular cohort of families. I'm looking at families who had children in 1968 and then looking at those children. So I'm not looking at retirees, and I'm not really speaking about all families. I'm speaking about, you know, this particular, it's my generation. It's people who are children in 1968 and now are in their 40s or so.
All right. Again, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. We'll get at least one more here, and we'll go to our line number one, and this would be someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. This might be off the topic of the day, but I'm curious to know how the Brookings Institution is organized. I mean, do you have permanent staff, and are they organized into different groups, sociology, economics, foreign policy, that sort of thing?
Well, I can say something briefly about the Brookings Institution. I've only been here for 2 years. I'm in the Economic Studies Department, and then we also have, let's see if I can name the four other ones. It's not a test. Governance Studies, and then Foreign Policy, and then we have a Metro section, and we have several other centers and things. And I'm also, I will say, within Economic Studies, I'm in the Center for Children and Families. So we have a particular focus on opportunities for children and investments in children and basically child and family policy. That's my area of expertise and interest.
All right. And again, maybe one of the best things to learn more about Brookings is to go to their website because you can see all of their various activities and things that they're interested in. And there is a lot of information there on domestic and also foreign policy matters as well. And this report that we've talked about here, if you'd like to dig into this in a little more detail and read some of the commentary on the kind of statistics that we've talked about, this report, Getting Ahead or Losing Ground, Economic Mobility in America, is available at the website of Brookings, so you can read that for free. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And on ago, again, we'll go to another caller. This is someone in Champaign, and it's line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have an interesting comment, I think, to make. My husband and I adopted one at a time three half-grown children in the early 70s. So they were born in 60, 64, 64. And we're both college educated, and none of them have moved into that class. Only one of those three has finished high school with a GED.
Yes?
Well, I'm waiting for a response.
Okay. Ms. Isaacs, you have some response?
Well, I'm also actually an adoptive parent, and my daughter's 23, so we'll find out if she finishes college. I guess I would say that the issues for adopted children are probably, that would be a longer conversation than other children, but one would hope, of course, that being college educated yourself, you would be able to pass along some of those advantages to your children. But I think it is hard. Not all families are able to do that.
Well, that has happened with my birth children who are younger, but these were the youngest was nine, just turning nine as we got her. So they already had a long history of whatever else beforehand. So that certainly, I would say, impeded them.
I would say that as the mother of an adoptive child, I think of her as coming from two families. And that's just the way I look at it, that she also was eight by the time she moved into my family. So I think that's one of the reasons it's more complicated to compare adoptive children to where their parents were, because they, in some sense, had two sets of parents.
Right. Okay.
All right. We're at the point here where we essentially have to finish. We have about a minute or so left. I guess here to finish, I would ask this. What does it mean? What are the consequences that people, Americans, I think, tended to believe that there is more mobility in America than there really is? mean, does that, if you continue to believe in a mobility that doesn't exist, then, you know, what follows from that?
I think that's one of our concerns, is that if people think there's more mobility, they'll be more accepting of the inequalities in our society, and that if people realize there's less mobility, they might then question whether it's fair to have huge differences between rich and poor if there aren't equal opportunities for everybody to attain those positions in society.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, for people who are interested in reading more about this, you can certainly do that by going to the Brookings website, the website of the Brookings Institution, looking at this report, Getting Ahead or Losing Ground, Economic Mobility in America. And it's very easy to go to their website. It's www.brookings.edu, and you can read this report in its entirety and in some detail. And our guest this morning, one of the contributors, Julia Isaacs. She is Child and Family Policy Fellow at the Brookings Institution, also has worked doing this kind of work, data and technical analysis for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and also the Congressional Budget Office. Ms. Isaacs, thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it. I think we did cover a lot of points in the report, and I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to people about economic mobility.
All right, great. Thanks.